Okay, celiac disease. So, you know, huge epidemic in celiac disease these days. You go to the grocery store, it's just, you expect to see a huge section selling gluten-free items. 10 years ago, that didn't exist. I didn't even know the word celiac disease. It's just amazing how this has just come out of nowhere. And I might add just the more general problem of food intolerances. When you look at the allergies that we're facing, the peanut allergies, the soy allergies, the casein allergies from the milk, these are allergies to proteins, and every one of those proteins is likely to be contaminated with glyphosate. And so I think more generally, peanuts are sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest, for example. And so is wheat. And so I think we're just getting glyphosate into the proteins, and as a consequence, the proteins can't be broken down, and then the body develops an immune reaction to the proteins, and then it gets these sensitivities that you can't eat those foods. Anthony Sampson and I wrote an entire paper on celiac disease, and we missed this point because we didn't, what I'm going to talk about in a moment here, because we didn't know about the idea that glyphosate might be substituting for glycine in protein synthesis. So it turns out that gluten contains a lot of prolines. Proline is one of those amino acids, remember, that are essential. Gluten contains a lot of prolines, and proline is actually difficult to break down. Now, the reason why proline is difficult is actually interesting. It's because it has something attached to the nitrogen. It has an extra carbon attached to the nitrogen, which is what glyphosate has. And so when I saw that, I hadn't realized that about proline. It's the only amino acid besides glyphosate that has an extra carbon attached to the nitrogen. But that does not stop it from going into the protein chain. And that means that my original thought that glyphosate couldn't be going into the chain was wrong, because proline is perfectly happy to do it, and it has the same model. And once I saw that, then I was much more comfortable with the idea that Anthony had, that glyphosate is getting into proteins. So proline, because of this extra carbon, is hard to break down. That means glyphosate's going to be hard to break down too, and in fact it's been shown that glyphosate, in fact they've even made chains of glycines with different things hooked onto the nitrogen, not just, you know, the methylphosphonyl glyphosate, but other molecules that have all kinds of stuff hooked onto the nitrogen. They can put those things together as chains, just like peptide chains. They call them peptoid chains. There's a whole research literature on this topic, and they're excited about these things because they can put onto the nitrogen various molecules that might have interesting biological effects that they could use as drugs. And the reason why they like it is because this thing is really hard to break down. So it sticks around a long time. I find that really scary. And that also means that these proteins that have this glyphosate in them are going to have that same problem. So prolylaminopeptidase is an enzyme that specializes in breaking the bonds of proline, the difficult amino acid to break down. And so first of all, it depends on manganese as a catalyst. And manganese is chelated by glyphosate and made unavailable. So that's going to be one problem. This is in the gut, so you're going to have the glyphosate there affecting this protein in the gut. But secondly, it contains a highly conserved GXSXGG motif and two other regions with conserved glycine. So three different parts of this protein have highly conserved glycines. Any of those can be susceptible to glyphosate substitution. And so if this molecule doesn't work, then you can't break down the gluten. And on top of that, the gluten's got, if it's got glyphosate in it, it's going to be even harder to break down. So on both sides of that fence, you're going to have trouble breaking down the gluten. And that's why you're going to end up with, especially with your leaky gut, you're going to get the gluten out into your system, and it's going to cause a reaction. And so, but of course, malabsorption due to celiac disease can lead to nutritional deficiencies, because the celiac messes up your body's ability to absorb various nutrients, you know, vitamins and things like that, and that can cause symptoms of autism. Okay, celiac disease, this is a picture from the paper that Anthony and I wrote on gluten intolerance and glyphosate, and you can see here that the yellow boxes are celiac disease, and the green line is glyphosate usage on wheat, not corn and soy, but wheat. And you can see quite a good match here between the rise in using glyphosate as a desiccant on the wheat right before the harvest and celiac disease. Okay, impaired blood flow, endothelial nitric oxide synthase, probably my most favorite enzyme. Really fascinating molecule, and I've written a lot about it. My colleagues and I have a theory about ENOS that's quite, I really believe is true, and we need validation. We haven't proven it. It's one of these things that makes a lot of sense. ENOS is famous for being able to make nitric oxide, and nitric oxide relaxes the blood flow, so it's really important in the vasculature. It's released by the endothelial cells, and that allows the blood to flow. But ENOS also has a pathological state in which it releases superoxide instead, and this is called Enos uncoupling. There's lots of papers about this. Enos is releasing superoxide instead of nitric oxide. When you mix nitric oxide with superoxide, you get something called peroxynitrite, which is really toxic. And some people have thought that peroxynitrite is behind many of the modern diseases that we're facing because it's so toxic. So you don't want to be mixing superoxide and nitric oxide, but Enos is a what's called a moonlighting enzyme. It's a neat word, moonlighting. It actually switches back and forth between two activities, one of which is to make the nitric oxide, but the other one is to make sulfate. This is our theory, and we have papers on this. When the Enos is attached to the membrane, it makes sulfate, and it uses superoxide to make that sulfate. But if it's substituted by glyphosate, it can disrupt its ability, just like the cytochrome C oxidase. It can end up spilling out the superoxide and causing trouble and not actually making the sulfate. Double hit. Very, very serious consequences of that. So Enos turns out to depend on conserved glycines both for dimer formation and for binding to the membrane. So Enos operates as two Enos molecules together with a zinc atom sitting inside a cavity. And the zinc atom draws in the superoxide, I believe, to make the sulfate. But so if you can't make the dimer, you can't make the sulfate, and the superoxide is just going to kind of go wild. And furthermore, Enos only does this when it's attached to the membrane. So if the other piece, which has glycines that are supposed to attach, there's a terminal glycine on Enos that makes it attach to the membrane. If you replace that glycine with anything else, it won't work. They've done that in the experiments. So you replace it with glyphosate, it can't attach to the membrane. If it can't attach to the membrane, it can't make sulfate. And that's why you end up with a massive problem with sulfate deficiency systemically. So I think this is really exciting. I was just delighted. Enos is also, by the way, a CYP enzyme. It's a cytochrome P450 enzyme, so it's going to also be affected by glyphosate through that pathway. So it is really getting clobbered by glyphosate, and I think that is a huge issue in our failing health today. Impaired Enos function leads to oxidative damage in the artery wall, and of course also this peroxynitrite that I mentioned gets produced if there's nitric oxide lying around as well. So it's going to be a deficiency in nitric oxide and a deficiency in sulfate and excess lateral collateral damage due to these superoxide radicals. Kidney disease. So the kidneys actually have a very interesting way of managing their iron. And I only learned this recently during this episode of trying to figure out all these proteins with their glycines. It's certainly the case that we have an alarming incidence of kidney failure here in this country, as well as among, most especially among young agricultural workers in sugarcane fields in Central America, and also in rice paddies in Sri Lanka. The Sri Lankans have figured it out that glyphosate is the cause of this kidney failure, and as a consequence, they've taken action. Their government, unlike our government, was reacted and said, oh my God, and decided we're going to ban this molecule. So they do not allow glyphosate on, for any purpose in Sri Lanka today. It's really great that they've done that. Because it was clear to them that glyphosate was causing this kidney failure epidemic in their young agricultural workers. So this particular kind of failure that glyphosate produces is actually very specific to these things called the proximal tubules, and it causes this necrosis of those tubules. And of course, the sugarcane is sprayed with glyphosate right before harvest, and so these workers who are spraying it are the ones who are getting sick. So what is really interesting to me is how the iron is managed by the kidneys. It actually is a symbiosis between human cells and bacterial cells. And the bacteria actually produce these things called siderophores, which are able to contain the iron inside a safe capsule. This is really important because free iron is extremely toxic, and it'll react with the superoxide and hydrogen, you know, the hydroxyl radicals and cause all kinds of trouble. That's well known. So these siderophores are going to hold on to the iron and make it safe, deliver it to the kidney, and then the kidney has actually special enzymes. These are cross-species enzymes that say, oh yes, good, here's a siderophore provided to me very nicely by this microbe. I will take it up and use it for my iron. And that's a way to get to the iron delivered to the kidney safely. So if those siderophores aren't being made, or if those receptors aren't working, the kidney is going to have iron deficiency problem, and also there's going to be an iron toxicity problem because the iron is now free rather than being hiding inside the siderophores. And that's exactly what you get. So Here's a paper that talks about this really fascinating process by which bacillus, this microbacillus, produces these siderophores, which look like this structure here. And then they hold on to the iron and keep it safe so that it's not going to cause damage. And then this tubule has this specialized enzyme that takes up the siderophore, and then the tubules can use that as a source of iron, which is really important for their catalytic activities. And so that both the siderophore and the receptor have critical conserved glycines. The siderophore has a couple of conserved glycines, and the protein that takes it up has a conserved GXW motif. So here's a paper, here's a plot from a paper that Anthony and I wrote. We didn't know about this particular piece of the story at that time, but we showed that there was almost a sevenfold increase in the incidence of glomerulonephritis over time from 1998 to 2010, which is the condition that is causing this kidney failure in these agricultural workers. And so now I feel like we can explain it through this defective iron uptake by the kidneys. Liver disease. Okay, liver cancer and glyphosate. Here's a picture of increased rate of liver cancer starting around 1996. Again, the yellow boxes are the cancer, the red is the glyphosate, and the blue is the GMO Roundup Ready crops. Fatty liver disease is a strong risk factor for liver cancer, and we have an epidemic in fatty liver disease. We have a sort of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD, that's caused by, you know, fructose and stuff like that. We have a lot of issues with people getting fat stores, excess fat stores in their livers. This plot on the right looks complicated, but we're just going to look at a few pieces of it. These things called Mallory-Denk bodies, this is the MDB formation on the right. These things are associated with this fatty liver disease, and they are caused by this pathway that's illustrated in the rest of the picture here. KEAP1 is the protein that I'm focusing on. KEAP1 is an interesting protein which hangs on to NRF2. So you see KEAP1, NRF2. KEAP1 grabs hold of NRF2, and then it also grabs hold to the cytoskeleton, and it says, okay, NRF2, you can't go into the nucleus. It holds it there attached to the cytoskeleton. If KEAP1 lets go of NRF2 or if KEAP1 lets go of the cytoskeleton, then the NRF2 can get into the nucleus, and when it does that, it'll turn on a whole bunch of protein synthesis and cause a whole bunch of things to happen. So KEAP1 has a conserved double glycine repeat that anchors it to the cytoskeleton. If that thing is glyphosates, it won't be able to anchor, and then the NRF2 will be able to get into the nucleus and cause the release of K8, which is a keratin. And keratin then is what causes the formation of these bodies, which have keratin in them. And so there's another interesting story that I want to end on before I get into how to fix the problem. Hyperkeratosis, this is a problem in us as well, I believe, and also in racehorses, for example. They're having a lot of issues that I think are connected to hyperkeratosis. I'm looking into that right now. But I want to focus on the birds at the moment. Beak deformities in the chickadees. And this is a picture of a chickadee that can't eat because its beak's so twisted around and deformed that it can't open seeds. And there's an epidemic in this problem in the chickadees, particularly in areas located near agricultural regions. Starting with the Great Lakes region in 1998, which is when they were just starting to get going with the GMO Roundup Ready crops in central Alaska, and in areas exposed to the California agricultural runoff. All these areas, they've got these chickadees that are having troubles with these beaks. Below here, I have the reference to a paper that was written in 2015, very detailed. They looked at lots of different metals, toxic metals. They looked at lots of different agricultural chemicals, big lists of stuff, couldn't find any connections. Same story, just like the anencephaly in Washington State. They didn't look at glyphosate at all and didn't find any connections. But it's easy to explain this with respect to glyphosate because of this effect that I just mentioned with KEAP1. And furthermore, these chickadees are going to be eating sunflower seeds, and the sunflower seeds are sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest. The chickadees are a very popular bird at the bird feeders. So they're getting glyphosate from their sunflower seeds, and that's causing their beaks to have this problem. And it's also a systemic problem in their body. It's showing up elsewhere in their problem as well, this overexpression of keratin. And as I said, we have similar problems ourselves. So finally, how to safeguard yourself and your family. This is fun. I really love this. Dandelions, you know. Eat dandelions. Dandelion leaves. So Roundup is toxic. This is a paper, a nice paper that talks about these common everyday plants that are healthful. They can provide you nutritional support for fighting glyphosate. And so they talked about the toxicity of Roundup to the liver and to embryonic cells at very low doses, far below the doses in agriculture. And so they said dandelions, barberry, and burdock, they mentioned specifically those three common plants that can protect from damage, especially if you eat them before you're exposed. And this was a lovely paper on cows. These cows were getting sick, and they tested their urine for glyphosate and found out that they had glyphosate in their urine. And I guess they've developed this treatment method, which is based on activated charcoal, bentonite clay, humic and fulvic acid, which are organic matter from the soil, and sauerkraut juice, which is going to be loaded with probiotics. So these are the treatments that they administered to these cows, and they showed that their symptoms improved and that the levels of glyphosate in their urine went down following these treatments. So I think humans could also make use of treatments of this sort. These things are pretty non-toxic, and I think they're available. Good things to think about in trying to detox glyphosate. Here's some nutrients, and of course there's many more, but these are some of my favorites that can help you, particularly help you heal the sulfate problem, because I think the sulfate problem is the key one. If you can get your sulfate levels built back up again, your brain won't be leaky anymore, your gut will heal, everything will fall into place, your blood will flow. So really, really important to get your sulfate up, but it's not easy because sulfate's hard to transport. And I talk a lot about this in some of my other talks, but today I don't have time, so I'll just mention it briefly. But some of these are sulfur suppliers, such as glutathione. Glutathione contains sulfur. And taurine is a really interesting molecule. It's an amino acid that contains a sulfonyl group, which is almost sulfate. So taurine can be a good source for sulfate. I love Epsom salt baths. You just get into the hot bathtub and you dump in some. You can just get the Epsom salts very easily at Whole Foods, for example, and dump them into the bath water and just soak for 20 minutes. You know, the sulfate, the Epsom salts are magnesium sulfate, and magnesium is also a good thing to get. So you get naturally magnesium and sulfate soaking through your skin, bypassing your gut, because lots of times people have issues with sulfur in their guts. People have sulfur-reducing microbes that have overgrown, probably because of glyphosate poisoning, and they can end up producing a lot of hydrogen sulfide gas, which can cause a lot of nasty issues. Probiotics, of course, I'm sure most people here know that. Vitamin C is a good one. Vitamin C is actually carries sulfate. And in fact, I suspect that vitamin C facilitates the transfer of sulfate onto the artery wall to help to make the blood work properly. Really, really nice. Vitamin C is very good. And of course, garlic I love. Eat as much garlic as you possibly can. That's a good source of sulfane sulfur, which is a really nice way to get your sulfur. Methyl tetrahydrofolate, I want to emphasize that's not folic acid, and I do not recommend folic acid. I've talked about that in previous talks. Folic acid is oxidized and it's missing the methyl group. So what it does is it works your liver real hard to try to fix it and can deplete your supplies in your liver. So you want to take methyl tetrahydrofolate if you're going to take folate. And cobalamin is B12, and that's another one that's actually crucial for sulfate synthesis and for some other things as well. So I think that's every... Oh, curcumin. Curcumin is what people often believe that's why the people in India have low rates of Alzheimer's, because of curcumin. And curcumin is also a really good sulfate transporter. Get grounded. So again, in other talks, I've talked about the electricity in the body and how essential it is and how the sulfates are important for making the electricity work. Sulfates have negative charge, but you can get negative charge right out of the ground. The earth is a giant negatively charged, you know, battery, so you just get the electrons flowing right into your body and helping you to regenerate the negative charge. Walking barefoot in the water at the beach is one of the best things you can do, especially on a sunny day, because the sunlight is also important. This is a picture of my kitchen table with various organic products. We don't buy anything if it's not organic anymore for our kitchen. When we eat out, we cheat because we can't find organic restaurants. I'm hoping eventually you'll have the organic choice, or even you'll have the organic restaurant. These are coming, and I'm looking forward to that, because then we don't eat out very much because of this. And when I travel, I bring stuff to eat in my suitcase, which is, just seems really silly, but I have to, because I can't afford to get too much poison, you know. I try to keep it low. Eat foods containing manganese. Some of these are wonderful foods. The oysters, any of the seafoods are really, really healthy. Seeds and beans and of course the greens, the dark green vegetables, these are all really good. Tea is a good source of manganese, and fish is also. And tofu is actually a good source of manganese, but I don't recommend tofu unless you can be sure that it's organic. And bread too, same problem. It has to be organic if you're going to eat bread. These are some foods that contain sulfur, and sulfur is super, super important. Cabbage, all the cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower. Eggs are a great source of lots of things. I really encourage eating, especially the egg yolk, eating lots of eggs. And healthy eggs, of course. Scallops, all the seafoods, clams, you know, lobster, crabs, scallops, those are all really good for you. And liver, if you could get it organic. Liver will be toxic if you can't. And chicken and nuts, so, and of course garlic and onions also, they're good sources of sulfur. So, in summary, glyphosate contamination in our food supply is a serious threat to health. Toxic mechanisms include mineral chelation, disruption of SIPE enzymes, and disruption of gut microbes. I believe glyphosate is the most important factor in the autism epidemic. Glyphosate may erroneously replace glycine during protein synthesis, and if it does, this explains why we have all of these correlations between glyphosate and a whole bunch of diseases that are on the rise today, including diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's, other neurological diseases, liver and kidney disease, vascular diseases, celiac disease, etc. Eating an organic diet rich in sulfur and manganese and probiotics can help protect from glyphosate poisoning. Thank you. So do we have time for questions? Oh, he go ahead. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. And then we'll get you next.
Sulfur in the urine.
Yes.
So they can. The kidney cannot hold it. And they, if it's low in the serum, you lose it, yes?
Yes.
And the only thing you can do, you can take Epsom baths or something like that.
Right.
But how does it go into your picture? With the you said the enzyme is also, the enzymes is making sulfate.
And yes, the enzyme, Enos, which makes sulfate, is defective, I believe, as a consequence of glyphosate poisoning.
They're more deficient. So
and also sulfotransferases, I didn't mention it, but they also have conserved glycines. These are the things that transport sulfate from one molecule to another, which are really important because sulfate is moved around a lot. Sulfate free in the blood is dangerous because it'll gel the blood. So you have to have these carrier molecules. And there's cholesterol and all the different sterols, vitamin D, and then all these neurotransmitters and the aromatic amino acids, all of these things transport sulfate and then hand it off to the artery wall to supply the sulfate in the artery wall, which will keep it working properly to make the blood flow. So, and also sulfate flushing through the kidneys is because of vitamin D deficiency. Vitamin D protects from that. Vitamin D the SIPE enzymes are needed to activate vitamin D. So we have an epidemic in vitamin D deficiency that's due to, I think, glyphosate poisoning of the SIPE enzymes.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, we had over here, right? Yeah.
So I notice a big correlation with kids with autism and ADHD and sensory integration disorder with pilaris keratosis. And could that be related, keratosis kind of chicken skin?
Keratosis, oh wow.
Could that be related to this?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, NRF2 is a response to oxidative damage. And you have oxidative damage because the cytochrome C oxidase isn't working because of the glyphosate. That causes the superoxide to get released. That causes NRF2 to be activated. And then on top of that, KEAP1 can't keep it out of the nucleus because if its glycine gets disrupted, it can't attach to the cytoskeleton. So that's two different ways in which you get over a stimulation of NRF2, which gives you excess production of keratin, which I think is causing, for example, choke in the horses, and also possibly their problems with their hooves. They have this founder. You know, the racehorses have a lot of problems that I think are due to glyphosate poisoning. I want to write a paper on that, but I haven't yet. But that's interesting. Keratosis in association with autism? Yeah, that's very, I should learn more about that.
Okay, I have a question. You had mentioned trying to avoid exposure through eating organic food. Has there been testing about how common it is in water? Do we need to be worrying about trying to do special purification of water? And if so, what has been found to be the most effective way of eliminating it from our kids' drinking water? And kind of conversely, what are we finding is helping break it down in nature, or is there anything that is, and what's the estimated time for that?
That's a good question. The water problem, I don't know very well, and I don't know if anybody in the audience knows. I would love to have the answer to that, whether the actual filtration processes that go on or how the water treatment plants, do they, in fact, break down the glyphosate? I suspect in part it has to do with what microbes are growing there, because there's actually only a few microbes that are smart enough to break that CP bond. The CP bond in glyphosate is a really strong bond and hard to break. And interestingly, Pseudomonas aeruginosa can do it. And also there's a microbe called Acinetobacter, which causes like a runny nose and gets into your lung cavity. That can break down glyphosate. And so I suspect a lot of kids have runny noses today all the time, it seems like to me. And I suspect that's Acinetobacter at work detoxing the glyphosate. So in the soil, you have, you know, certain microbes that can break it down. But there's only a few. It's actually quite remarkable that not very many of the microbes are able to break that CP bond.
How would those microbes...
Zen has an answer? Oh, good. Zen has an answer on water. I should expect her to, because she's done a lot of work with water, so she'll be able to clarify that in her talk coming up next. Is that it?
Well, I was going to ask, as far as the microbes go, do you know if the ones that would help with that are often eliminated by the chlorine they put in water?
Could be. But I will say the ones that are able to fight it in your body are often also pathogens. So Salmonella and Pseudomonas are both serious pathogens that have multiple antibiotic resistance. And glyphosate actually causes multiple antibiotic resistance. I haven't talked about that today, but I believe that there's papers that have shown that. And those two microbes, because they can metabolize glyphosate, they're able to survive when the other ones are getting killed off. And that's why we have that epidemic in those issues, I think.
I'm Lorena Vena Roche, clinical immunology from Venezuela. Sorry, I can see her. And you mentioned about the live vaccines increasing the antibodies. We have a big cohort where we have found very big increased amounts of IgG, 7,000, 12,000 for mumps or varicella or even measles.
Oh,
which
yes.
Cannot be explained by any of the immunologists I've tried to reach out to.
Wow,
and
interesting.
Maybe what you're talking about would be the way to get to the problem.
I think
can
you're probably right.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, well, in fact, I'm going to talk more about the vaccines on Friday. I found it very, very interesting, and what I suspect is that in the case of the measles virus, which is the MMR vaccine, as I said, the measles is growing on glyphosate, if I'm right, with the gelatin, puts it into its proteins. There's a particular protein, measles hemagglutinin. And that protein, and autistic, there was a paper from 2002 that showed that autistic kids, they looked at 125 kids, and 60% of them had really high titers in response to the hemagglutinin. So hemagglutinin is what you actually need to respond to in order to get the antibody response that they're looking for to be vaccinated. I mean, another paper showed that hemagglutinin is the one you care about. But if you get too much hemagglutinin antibody, especially if the virus gets into the brain, and then your brain's immune system develops those antibodies, then hemagglutinin resembles, there's this peptide in hemagglutinin that resembles myelin basic protein. And so you get autoantibodies to myelin basic protein. And 90% of those kids had autoantibodies. 60% of the autistic, 90% of them, over half the autistic kids had autoantibodies to myelin basic protein, which is going to attack the myelin sheath and probably cause the autism symptoms. So to me, that seems like the most plausible explanation for autism that I have heard.
Thank you.
Thank you for your talk, Dr. Seneff. I have been studying chlordane poisoning for several years, which was a pesticide that was outlawed in the 1980s, and I had a very toxic exposure to that, which I believe contributed to my brother contracting leukemia and subsequently passing away, and both of us have severely affected autistic children.
Wow.
Now, I know chlordane is not your area of expertise, but I did just want to share with you that I do believe in my own research that people of my generation who are producing these children who have autism, it could be something going on in utero with that. And we are trying to learn ways to detox from chlordane, though there's not much information out there. And I'm wondering, and you may or may not know, but it's certainly going to be beneficial for me to use some of the therapies that you suggested for detoxing the glyphosate, which is also an issue because we used to eat a normal Western diet, which we don't do any longer.
Right.
But I wonder if just getting these pesticides out of our body by these chelating methods that you spoke about, and we also have been using homeopathy to clear ourselves of the chlordane, if that would be beneficial, as well as the fact that I think it's important for us to all think about maybe different ways that we can treat our lawns.
Yes.
Because we're being exposed by the landscapers to everybody spraying on their lawns.
I know.
So is there a suggestion that you have for what we can tell our landscapers to use? I mean, nothing?
I actually met someone just this past weekend at a festival who has who is cutting-edge organic on how to treat lawns. So I got his number, and I'm going to contact him and have him do our lawn. We have lawn service, and we absolutely refuse to let them use any of the toxic chemicals. So as a consequence, we have a bunch of weeds in our lawn, and our neighbors don't like that, but we don't care because it's just like people need to get used to the idea that it's okay to have dandelions. I mean, in fact, they're useful, you know. You know, don't worry about the weeds. I just think it's crazy that we think we have to have these beautiful manicured lawns, and as a consequence, we're poisoning our children. It's so stupid. Yeah, I mean, we just need to get over that, you know. And look, think of the soccer field, too. I suspect the soccer field is loaded with glyphosate, and all the soccer players are getting sick from that, you know. So it's just, we need to fix it. We need to be aware that we don't need to have beautiful lawns. We just, and of course, there are organic ways, too, you know, vinegar and there's some things you can do, but they're not as effective, of course. But that's, you know, of course, you can always pull weeds by hand, which is what I do, but that gets tedious, you know. But you just shouldn't have to obsess on the weeds, I feel. Are we?
What further studies do you want to see done to prove your replacing glycine?
It actually shouldn't be hard. I'm trying to goad these people on to do it because they keep thinking the burden should be on us to prove that it's there. But I don't see why the burden shouldn't be on them to prove that it's not happening. You know, it's equal. And they can do it. I can picture the experiment you would do to prove this. And so I've been contacting people and saying, hey, you know, why don't you do this? I have a... I don't have a lab, so I'm not equipped to do it myself. And of course, I don't have money either, so there's some issues, and no one wants to fund something like this because, so it's going to happen eventually. I'm just going to get them, I'm going to shame them into doing it, basically, I think. I hope. Either my side or their side. Somebody's going to decide to take a look. Anthony is finding evidence from the early studies of DuPont, where DuPont had done radio-labeled glyphosate, and then they found the label in these proteins, you know, they gave it to the animal, and then when they got the tissues with the protein in it, they had the label in there, but they didn't see the glyphosate. Because the really awful thing is that when it's in the protein, it doesn't show the signal. You have to break the protein down before you can see it, and the protein's really hard to break down because there's glyphosate in it. So you have to use a lot of pepsin and trypsin, all these digestive enzymes. And he said DuPont had to run it for a week with these digestive enzymes before they could dig out the signal. And then they said, oh, my God, the glyphosate's there. So the obvious thing is that it's in the protein. You know, it's in the protein. To me, it seems very clear. Time. Jen is worried because she's supposed to go on at 12:15 and we're supposed to have a break, so you're going to have a really short break.
Yeah, I just
we better quit.
Rodeo is Roundup to be used for aquatic weeds. It's approved to be used for aquatic weeds. So if you're wondering if it's in the water, yeah, it can be. And then are your slides available on your website?
She could. Oh, yes, right. They are on my website. They're already posted. I should have said that. You Google my name, but if you want to know, P-E-O-P-L-E, people.csail, my, C-S-A-I-L, my lab, CSAIL, .mit.edu/SENEF, S-E-N-E-F-F. But if you just Google SENEF, you'll be able to find my website. And I've got them posted under a whole section on Autism One with all my Autism One talks. Okay, we got to quit. So thank you.